So Baruch Hashem, we're in Adar Asheni, and the Yichud, what's unique and exceptional about Adar Asheni is that it contains the Yontif of Purim. And as the Gemara says, it's Bedafka because it's Adar Asheni that it has Purim. And that despite the fact, as we looked at earlier, back at the beginning of Adar Arishin, that according to the Kviyas of the Halacha, Adar Arishin is the principal Adar. So a person has made a neder that he fasted until Adar, or he wouldn't, I shouldn't say fast, he would refrain from something in his life until Adar, and made a neder. Rosh Chodesh Adar Arishin, Aleph Adar Arishin comes goodbye, the neder is over. That's the Shulchan Aruch Siman Reish Chof. That's the Stam view of the Shulchan Aruch, and he quotes as a Yeshomer of the Rambam, clearly the Halacha meaning to be like the first view, and as the Goyin goes to town to show us all over the Shulchan Aruch that that's the essential view, and he leaves as a difficult point of understanding why the Shulchan Aruch said when it comes to your Tzaitan, we follow other ways. So Adar Rishon is the real deal, Adar Beis is the second, it's the extra month. But nevertheless, the Gemara says it's an Indian of Adar Asomach Lenisan of Mismach Gula Lagula, that the Gulas Haman and the Gulas Mitzrayim should be in association with each other. In other words, we have the season of redemption, as it were. You know, it's hard. We human beings are limited. We cannot experience the full depth of all different types of emotions in the same time frame. So part of what we do in Yadis is we parcel out different types of avodah for different types of the year. Elul is a time for reflection. But that's our focus. Come to Sukkot, we forget the reflection. It's a time for joy, simcha. Pesach, we think about matters of the Gula. The 7 weeks of Sfira, we prepare for Matan Torah. We have 3 weeks of mourning period. We focus, we spend time to focus. It's very difficult to jump around. So therefore that's the higher notion of mismach, gula lagula, that we have one mindset of being focused on matters of gula, our relationship in that aspect with the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. And once we start Purim, we roll straight from that into Pesach. If we did it in Adar Arishin, there would be this big empty space in the middle of 2 months. So Adar Asheni, it's Yichud, what's unique, what's significant about it is that its Purim was dedicated to Adar Asheni. So it's the time truly to focus on the lessons, what Purim is, some lessons we could draw from the Megillah concerning what our perspective on Purim is. One point that I like to begin with, that Sifrei Machshava tell us that our Chagim are significantly different than non-Jewish holidays. We celebrate July 4th in this country. It's the day of the founding of the Republic. It's a very significant day. Yeah, but what happens on July 4th? Is July 4th substantively today any different than July 3rd or July 5th? No. No different. It's a day of commemoration since the Republic was founded on this day. And we commemorate it on that day. But there's nothing especially unique about July 4th which lets it stand apart from July 3rd or July 5th, any other day of the year. And what's the avodah of July 4th? The avodah of July 4th is to have a barbecue. You know, if you're a good American, you have a barbecue on July 4th. A chag is not merely a commemoration of that which something of historical significance took place on this day. What Sifrei Machshava tell us is that the spirituality of the day reasserts itself over and over in Jewish history in the same time frame. Pesach is a time of Geula. We can experience aspects of Geula uniquely at the time of Pesach. Shavuos is a time of Kabbalah Satara. There are unique aspects of acceptance of the Torah which we can achieve on Shavuos that we can't achieve any other time. because the same spiritual constellation which existed or was created in the first Chag repeats itself year after year in the time frame of that Chag. Tisha B'Av is a mourning period. The evil of that day as a reality in all of history. Similarly, Purim is a time of Yeshua. And that's repetitive in history. Now it's interesting that one of the Jewish imponderables, and the Rishonim already addressed it in the beginning of Masechta Megillah, we have a fast day on the 13th of Adar. It was part of the Jewish calendar, apparently, since time immemorial. But the Rishonim did not find a source. Apparently, there is some source in the Midrash Tanchuma, I think in Parshas Bereishis, where it is mentioned. But the Rishonim did not find a source for it. So they're all over the map with all types of creative reasons for it. There'll be Ram as a reason for it, and the Ravid as a reason for it. All types of reasons. We're not even sure it's supposed to be called Tinus Esther, even. May have nothing to do with Esther. According to one view, the view of the Rabbeinu Tam, that it was normative to fast on the day that they started the battle. And consequently, it's a commemoration of that fast. Nothing to do with Esther. Esther's fast was in Nisan. This was almost a year later in Chodesh Adar. According to the Ravid, it also, I don't want to go into the Ravid now, but it has nothing to do with Esther. It has to do with Kriyas and Megillah. The most fascinating, in a way the most incisive of the Pshatim, is one of the Rishonim called the Kolbo. And the Kolbo offers a Pshach which is most rooted in the Chag itself, and rooted in the Megillah. In the Megillah we read a Pasuk that they recorded Divrei Atzaymais Bezaakosam, the fast days and the Tfilas. And the Kolbo tells us that Purim is a two-day yontif. Two-day yontif. What's the two-day yontif? In the celebration of Purim we ought to do two things. One is to commemorate and relive how they achieved the Yeshua, and how did that take place? Tzoyim, means tshuva, tzoyim, and tefillah, bizar kosam. So each year, we should involve ourselves in the things which effectuated our salvation at that time. So we have Dibrei Tzoyim as bizar kosam, and that's on Yud Gimel Adar. Yud Dalet Adar, which is the day of the celebration of the victory that they had the day before, that we celebrate also, enjoy. Now, according to the Kolbo, they're both rooted in the Megillah itself. And in fact, it's appropriate that it's called Tinus Esther, because according to him, it's really to commemorate the process of the Tzimus and Zakosim of Chodesh Nisan, of Esther. And that's how they were saying, with Divrei Tzimus and Zakosim. And we commemorated it as a part of a two-day celebration of Purim. Now, so it tells us that the Divrei Atzoymos B'Zakosam are an essential part of Purim, number one. Number two, Purim is a time of Yeshua. We had a great, great salvation. And Haman was a very formidable foe. Chazal referred to a ruthless king, a ruthless Jew hater, as Melech Kosher Kahaman. Haman was the figure that we read about at the very, very end of the Toichacha in Parshas Kisavo. The last klola of the Toichacha, v'his makartem shom lo yivechem, v'ein koina. And Rashi says, v'his makartem, not v'nim kartem, you will be sold. You will attempt to sell yourself as slaves, because in that fashion you'll survive. But v'ein koina. Your enemies have no interest in purchasing you as slaves. They want only to destroy you, to kill you. This was the ultimate klolo, the final klolo of the Torah. This was a philosophy of Haman. Haman had no interest in enslaving the Jews. Eliminate them from the world. This is the shita of the modern day Amalekites, the Germans, Yimach Shemam V'Zichron. The essence of what they wanted to do is to eliminate the Jews from the world. Paro, on the other hand, to the contrary, this was the furthest thing from his interest to eliminate the Jews. He had a slave empire, and he wanted to maintain it. That didn't mean that at times they didn't abuse an individual slave for their advantage. But collectively, the Jews were not in danger. And Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi makes this point, that if we recite Hallel, Shira, on Pesach, which celebrates Me'avdus L'Cheirus, then certainly we should have to recite Shira on Purim, which celebrates Me'mobus L'Chaim. Haman had a different agenda. His agenda was to eliminate Klal Yisrael. In his time, it was Zeicher, the Rabbi Rishonim spared us from the one that had this philosophy before he harmed us. Unfortunately, in modern times, we were not so Zeicher. But we were Zeicher. In that milieu, we were Zeicher. So it's a time of Yeshua, phenomenal Yeshua. A person had the approval of the king, and the local population, which would have been more than glad to carry it out. He himself wielded phenomenal power, and after all of that, it came to naught. And how does it come to naught? Not with the king who loves Klal Yisrael, but with the king who hates Klal Yisrael as much as Haman. Chazal tell us in the Gemara and Megillah that the relationship of Haman and Achashverosh was similar to actually a maisa that happened with Tel Zishiva. On the property, there was a part that was sort of like a valley, and it was not very useful to them because it was the state was building a highway next to the yeshiva. Oh, the state had to dig that tons of earth to get rid of. They didn't want to have to haul it by truck all over the place. So they saw they had this great empty gorge next to the yeshiva that they could dump it into. So they came to tell the yeshiva, and they offered to pay them to allow them to use their property to fill it in. Now, tell the yeshiva was the first thing that they wanted, but they had no use from it as a gorge. So they even got money. Now, they dumped it, they took down the hills and the mountains of earth, and they dumped them into and they filled it in. So that's what Chazal said. This is the marshal of Haman and Ahasuerus. One had the earth and one had the gorge. And one was only too glad to accommodate the next. Ahasuerus, in fact, as I pointed out other times, was a more cunning enemy of Klal Yisrael than Haman was. Haman believed in raw power. He has a bunch of thugs, and he'll do what he wants. Ahasuerus was far more cunning than that. He realized that Haman's approach in and of itself was doomed to failure. There were many that tried to eliminate Klal Yisrael from the world by his time, and none of them met a good fate. But Ahasuerus realized, so what does he have to do? If he wants to succeed, he has to drive a wedge between Klal Yisrael and the Rabbeinu Shalom. This was not in Haman's scope. Haman was a thug. That's it. You want to eliminate somebody, you get a hit team and you send them out there and that's it, finished. You know, nothing more to it than that. Ahasuerus was a total skeptic about that approach. To succeed, you have to drive a wedge between the Rabbeinu Shalom and Klal Yisrael. How will you do it? By involving them in Chet. One is Bizoyer HaMikdash, as we spoke about the last Shabbos that I was here. And second, he took a page from the playbook of Bilam. Bilam comes, he's hired by Balak, and wherever he drays, wherever he wanders, what happens? He just keeps getting more and more brochas to Klal Yisrael. And Bilam finally gets frustrated. As much as I ask you, all that happens is he keep giving him more brochas. So Bilam tells him, listen, I told you before I came, whatever the Rabbeinu Shalom tells me, Oysa Eshmo Ledaber, that's what I have to tell. And the Rabbeinu Shalom was giving out brochas, so that's what I have to sell. But Bilam was not one to go home empty-handed without any accomplishment to his name. So he gave Balak one piece of parting advice. Gemara in Sanhedrin says. And that explains it, the very last part of Parshas Balak. The Parshas de Baal Peor. He tells Balak that, listen, one thing I know, was Elokeyim shel Eilu Sonei Zimahu. The Rabbeinu Shalom despises immorality and lewdness. So if you engage them in immorality, you'll drive a wedge between them and the Rabbeinu Shalom, then the Rabbeinu Shalom will get angry at them, and then you'll accomplish something. And in Kachoya, 24,000 people got killed. So Ahasuerus was an astute student of history. So he took a page from the playbook of Bilam, and part of the scenario of the Sudas Ahasuerus was that it should be a very licentious happening. And together with drink and the licentiousness, the rest would take care of itself. So he was a more cunning foe than Haman was. So even with the elimination of Haman, we were not on safe grounds. Because in fact, the story of the Megillah, if you follow it carefully, even after Haman is hung, the Jews are not saved. Perek Ches, Esther comes again to Ahasuerus. And she tells him, Toivu ani ba'ino, v'choshu adobu lefnei ha-melech, yikosev, l'hoshu was ha-svarim, achshev was Haman, etc. She still has to rescind the king's missive to destroy Klal Yisrael. The Ahasuerus could have easily just said, well, listen, you know, we cannot rescind any missive that the king sends, because they'll lose all authority in that fashion. And therefore, listen, whatever happens, happens. And he could have gone back to the palace and the Sunni Yisrael Luminayim across the whole empire. And Haman was right in one observation. They are Mufuzar Mufayrd Binam. Now, if you have a few million Jews in one place together, so we can organize a collective defense. But if we spread out and all the Medinas of Ahasuerus, a few here, a few there, a few in the next place, we're defenseless. So they can just rise up against us. Ahasuerus could have turned around and gone back to the palace and said, there's nothing I could do. And the anti-Semites would have popped out of the woodwork and they would have done the thing. So even after Haman was put to death, we were still not saved. So that's part of the enormity of the nest. It's not only how Haman is thwarted as he's on the cusp of success. It's on the way to Ahasuerus to eliminate Mordechai and finish off the Jewish people. And what happens? On the cusp of success, at the threshold of success, the tables are turned on him. But that didn't solve our problem. That's all part of the problem. But Ahasuerus was himself a formidable enemy. So formidable, in fact, that when he asked later, Miuzeva Ezahu Ashamalo Uliva Lassus came, so Esther has a visceral reaction. She wanted to give the non-PC answer to the question. Right? And she naturally and instinctively started to point to Ahasuerus. Because without him, none of this could have happened. There couldn't have been a Haman. Right? But the Malach came and pushed her hand, that her hand, you know, shot towards Haman, and not towards Ahasuerus. But her visceral reaction was towards Ahasuerus. So this is part of the nest, the phenomenalness. It wasn't only that we succeeded in bringing Haman down, that still didn't solve our problems. That Ahasuerus itself at this point decided it was in his interest, for whatever reason, to join the side of Klal Yisrael, to go with that tide. And this is what's Matzel Klal Yisrael. It's a time of phenomenal Yeshua. Because it's a time of Yeshua, it's a time of Eis Rotzen. It's a time when a tefillah could be very, very readily mekubal, accepted by the Rabbeinu Shalom. But we have to take the tefillahs on Purim are a very serious affair. They have to be taken very seriously. It's a phenomenal opportunity. And Eis Rotzen. It's a time to celebrate, is a time to celebrate, yes. With the time to daven, for tefillah, the time for tefillah. And the tefillah should be with a tremendous focus. Because it's an Eis Rotzen. So this is the first thing we need to understand. That we understand a little bit the enormity of the Ness. How enormous the Yeshua was. It's a man of phenomenal Yeshua. And Ramayla is a time of tefillah. Tefillah has to be taken very, very seriously. And the Ness doesn't stop with Purim. That still didn't resolve our problem. At the very end of the Megillah, the last pasuk, say Ki Mordechai Yehudi Mishkan Amelach Achashverosh Motzi L'Roi Vechov Doiresh Doiver Tov La'amo V'Doiresh Shalom L'Chol Zaro. Very nice. But Rashi tells us, what does it mean Rotzi L'Roi Vechov? That he had his detractors. Some people had a negative eye towards Mordechai. So the Shaila is, this is in a way, this is the hesped for Mordechai, this pasuk. I mean, this enormous figure, this great figure in Jewish history. He had wielded phenomenal power, and Dover Tov La'amo used it to intervene on behalf of Klal Yisrael with Dorah Sholom L'chol Zaro, and to bring about tranquility for the Jewish people. So in the midst of this, he tell me a left-handed compliment, Rotzu L'roi Vechov. You know, don't forget, he had his detractors. Not everyone says it was so great. Let it be true, but that's the hesped that you give for him. And in the middle of the hesped, you say, oh, by the way, there were those that say, he wasn't such a big lamed, he wasn't such a big tzaddik, you know. There's a malari, there's another take on him, too. What's, does it belong here? So I think that the pshat is that Mordechai looked at the scene. What was the critique? Pirshu Avena Mitzvah Sanhedrin? Because Mordechai entered the world of politics. And in fact, we find that he fell one seat in significance in the Sanhedrin because of that. So now he had to run a government. He couldn't lock himself in the Beis Medrash and learn. He had to deal with, if you want to be prime minister and have power for what to be in charge, so you have to be in charge. You have to see the garbage is collected and whatever else, the prisons run and the police department works and all the things that have to take place in a malucha. The army is in place, etc. All comes stops on his desk.
Yeah, but how is he on Sanhedrin if he's in Paras and Sanhedrin's in Yerushalayim?
They were from the, these are the Sanhedrin that went into Golos. This is not, they were not functioning in Eretz Yisrael at this time.
I thought they had started this in
the Christian. What? But the members of the Sanhedrin went into Golos.
Okay.
So this is with his colleagues. They were not functioning per se as Sanhedrin anymore. You're right. So it was a very strange decision for one of the Gdolei Ador to suddenly throw his hat into the ring for politics. You know. So what happened? Why did he suddenly join the political world? Jewish history, as most history of the world, there's no shortage of politicians. Gdolei Ador are few and far between, even in the best of times. So who can afford the luxury that the Gdolei Ador should become a politician? So what did Mordechai want? But Mordechai faced the same problem that Yaakov Avinu faced. After Shimon Levi destroyed Shechem, so what does Yaakov Avinu tell them? Morally, you were justified. The Rambam is his explanation. The Ramban is his explanation. Morally, I don't have a critique of what you did. But in your youthful enthusiasm to stand, you know, for the honor of your sister, and morally correct to do so, but you also showed the imprudence of youth. You know, I'm a small little band of people. If the Malchai Canaan get outraged that we wipe one of them off and they decide to strike, what are we going to do? We're a tiny band. How many do we have? Right? When they went to Mitzrayim, ladies, b'shivim nefesh yordu al b'sechol of Mitzrayim. And this, they weren't even up to there yet. So what are we going to do? So his critique was on practical grounds, you failed. So the Rabbanu Shalom provides them with protection with Chus Yaakov Avinu, Chazal tell us, and they get away with it. So Mordechai looks at the scene. Good. Haman is dead. 75,000 Jew haters we took out also. Good. So now what? So now they're going to go to sleep. What's going to prevent them from reorganizing and seeking vengeance? What do you mean? You took out 75,000 of our countrymen. So what's going to stop them? And Haman was right. Mefuzer Mefuzer Ben Haman. We're spread out. We don't have means of collective defense. So what are we going to do? How are we going to survive this? Yeah, it's true. We won the day, but we may lose the battle. Yeah, we may won the battle. We may lose the war. So Mordechai makes a radical decision. And Esther puts him into office. And he gives him base home. He gives him the prime minister's residence. And moves into 10 Downing Street. That's it. He's in charge now. He's in charge. So now the bureaucracy has to march to his tune. You know, this is when they do, when all the dust settles, this is the Persian Empire. This is not Her Majesty's England, and this is not the United States of America. The Prime Minister wielded absolute power. If you crossed him, he did so upon pain of death. So when Mordechai tells the bureaucracy that the Jews are to be protected and exalted, that's the final word. You don't dare dissent. So he spends this period of his life in the political world, for what reason? To save Klal Yisrael. So even after the death of Haman, it was a very dicey situation. And that's what Chazal are telling us. This is not when the dust finally settled, most people supported him, and some people were against what he had done. Mordechai understood this from day one. For the Gadol Hador to decide that he's going into the world of politics is never going to be digested by everyone. No matter what the scene is, they'll say it's not necessary, someone else could have done it, it wasn't so dangerous, they're overawed, right? It says, V'rabim me'am yoritz misyadim, t'inofo pochad Mordechai aleyam, and that's whatever. You'll get away with it, whatever it is. You don't need to stay in politics forever, you could be there a short time, leave, they'll have all types of stories. 7,000 stories, what he should have done. Good. Mordechai understood that from the beginning. And who were his critics? If it was the Jewish tabloids of Shushan, so Mordechai would have slept comfortably at night. That's easy. But who were his critics? Pirshu Mimenu Mitzvah Sanhedrin. From the leading Talmid Chacham of the generation, he had a group that were critical of him, that said he messed it up. That stings. But Mordechai was willing to make that decision despite the fact that he knew that it would cost him dearly. And it would be he would live with pain from that decision. He knew that some of his colleagues would look askance at him. And that was his greatness. His greatness was that he did what he had to do for Klal Yisrael, undeterred. You know, if his reputation will be sullied by some, so be it. Not concerned. He has to do what's right for Klal Yisrael. And so this situation, this dicey situation that starts with the rise of Haman, even the defeat of Haman, finally Achashverosh's consent, and it's not even resolved with that. It's an ongoing problem. It demands that Mordechai Yehudi sit in the prime minister's office for years to keep the, or to allow the survival of Klal Yisrael. So we celebrate on Purim as a phenomenal Yeshua. So many different steps and such a protracted process necessary to assure the victory of Klal Yisrael. And Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi says that we recite Hallel, because this was not me'avdus l'chairus, this was me'mobus l'chaim. It's interesting that in the next piece of Gemara, the Gemara has three approaches, and apparently only one of them fits with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi. The Gemara asks the question, what happened to Hallel on Purim? It's not recited in the Seder HaTfilah. So the Gemara tells us first it's not recited on a Nes in Chutz La'aretz. So the Gemara asks about Yetzias Mitzrayim, they did recite Hallel. So the Gemara says that's before they came to Eretz Yisrael. But once they came to Eretz Yisrael, only in the Isgalus HaManes and Eretz Yisrael is really to say Hallel. The Gemara tells us, Akati Avdi Achashverosh Hanan. We were still subjects of Achashverosh. When all the dust settled and everything Mordechai accomplished, at the end of the day, the Beis HaMikdash was not standing. According to the Cheshbon, it would seem to be about another 9 years after the Megillah, because right, it was in the 12th year, the story with Haman and Mordechai's defeat of Haman. And Shnas Shalosh Lemolcha was, according to Achashverosh's Cheshbon, the end of the 70 years, and that was 18 years early by his miscalculation. So another 9 years were to take place after the Megillah until we started the binyan of the second Mikdash. So Akati Abdi Achashverosh Hanan. When all the dust settles, listen, there's no way some Mikdash. We have no sovereignty, and we're subjects of the Persian Empire. No great place. You know, we survived. You know, it's the prime minister that made the 17th attempt to assassinate the prime minister, and he survived again. Okay, it's an Ishken Yontif. You know, he's still around to tell the tale. Very nice. What's coming next? When's the 18th time coming? So that's why we don't recite Hallel. And finally, the Gemara brings a teretz, which is interesting, because the one that the Rambam quotes is Kriyosa Zui Halila. There is a Hallel. This apparently fits in with Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi, that we have to recite Shira. But what is the Hallel? The Kriyasa Megillah is the Hallel. So there is a Hallel. Elamai. So why don't we recite the regular Hallel? He doesn't object because he didn't say a Nesra B'chutz or he wouldn't recite Hallel. So why don't we recite the regular Hallel? If the Hallel fits for all the Chagim of the year, all of a sudden that is in Purim, it doesn't fit. So the Chayr, the answer is because Akati Avdi Achashverosh Hanan. We're still subjects of Achashverosh, meaning this wasn't the greatest level of celebration. There was a lot left to be desired. And therefore, the conventional Hallel didn't fit. And perhaps there's another level to it. Because we're in Golis, necessitated a different type of Hallel. The conventional Hallel doesn't fit. Why? Find a very interesting Gemara. Shiluch Olahem Esther Lechachamon. Esther sent a message to the Chachmei Hador. Kavuni l'doros. I want that this Nes of Purim, which I was an integral part of, should become a permanent feature in the Jewish calendar. So Chazal responded, the wisdom of maturity and prudence and experience. The Sanhedrin sends back to Kina Atmar Erasalena. Do you wish to arouse the non-Jewish enmity towards us? So Rabbi Hanano says a very simple pshat, that if you enshrine it as a Jewish holiday, so this is going to remain for all generations. So the non-Jews of Persia will be reminded of this constantly, of what we did, that we have made it part of history. So better let it fade from history, and they should forget about what we did. because it's not so easy to live down. As Mordechai Ehudi spent the rest of his life trying to deal with this problem. So Esther answered them a cryptic answer. He says, "Kvaksuvani the Malchei Modayu for us. I'm already written in the archives of Malchei Modayu for us." So according to Rabbeinu Chananel, what it means, listen, we made the Shushan Times already. That's it. We're in the newspaper of records. So there's nothing we could do about it. We entered the historical record. So this is something we're going to have to live with. So that's not a reason to shy away from it. But Rashi tells us an interesting shot. Rashi tells us the problem is not that they'll recollect, but we're making a yontif out of it. It's bad enough you killed the goyim, now you're going to go dance on the graves. That they're not going to forgive us for. So why don't she answer them, "Kvaksuvani, I'll say for Dibra Yom and the Malchei Modayu for us." The answer doesn't answer the question. The brothers were dancing on their graves. Okay, so it's part of the history book, so what? But there's a long way from that between being in the history books for us going out every year and dancing that we killed them. That's not going to go down too well. So what did Esther answer? So I thought that I have a kasha on the kasha, but I'll still proceed with it because Rav Nissen Alpers at Tzal told me that the conclusion that I came to is seen in Achreinu, same conclusion. And that is the next to last posik in the Megillah, which is the paraphrase really of what Esther said. "Kvaksuvani al sefer divrei hayom and the malchei foros amodai ki." So it tells us, "So foroshas gedulas Mordechai, alohem ksuvim al sefer divrei hayom and the malchei modai foros." So she paraphrased the next to last posik of the Megillah. Now, what is this posik telling us? I have a kasha because on the kasha. The kasha is that this pasuk seems an oddity. The rest of the life of Mordechai, is it relevant to us or not relevant to us? Right. We did not write Tanakh as a history book. As Chazal tells us, the Nevuah Shehutzrichu LeDoros, if it has timeless lessons, it's written. If it doesn't have timeless lessons, we didn't write it down. Let it, if it was timely and it was forgotten afterwards, it's fine. So the rest of the story of Mordechai's life is relevant to us or not? If it's relevant, so then it should have been written in Nach. And any of us can go find the Sefer Divrei Yom and the Malchei Modayu for us. So it got lost. Elamai, you'll tell me, it wasn't important. So it wasn't important. Who cares that it's in Sefer Divrei Yom and the Malchei Modayu for us? What's the relevance? My kasha on the kasha is that there are many such psukim in Sefer Melochim, which also, and the king, and it says the rest of it, the story of his life is in place X. You can look it up. One of the conclusion I reached, and I said Rav Albert Zatzal told me that he saw this in Achreinu, that what Esther was saying was the following. If you want to make a uniquely Jewish celebration to celebrate that the Rabbeinu Shel Olam smashed the Jewish enemies, we're going to win for a hard time. We can't do such a thing in sitting in the Golos in Persia. So that's not what we're going to do. We're going to do something else altogether. And with this, we understand the nature of the Megillah. There are a number of odd things in the Megillah. The fact that the Rabbeinu Shalom's name is not mentioned, very peculiar, right? Because I'll have to tell us wherever it says Amelech and not Amelech HaChashverosh, it has a double meaning. It means both Achashverosh and the Rabbeinu Shel Olam. But the Rabbeinu Shel Olam, he didn't break the ice. He didn't even get a cameo appearance in the Megillah. Then what's especially strange is why is it that Achashverosh gets such a good write-up in the Megillah? Basically, he's made to look like a fool, like a dupe. A dupe. A guy that wasn't so on top of his political game, and someone took him for a ride. But at the end of the day, he got it right. Chazal tell us he was as evil or more evil than Haman was. So what does he get such a clean write-up? The answer is, Esther told him, we don't dare write this up as a Jewish document that God came and struck down our enemies. That's all we need. What we're going to do is state that this is a celebration of our empire, that we have a benevolent king that has the interests of his citizens in mind. And yeah, there was an evil and ruthless man named Haman who wanted to destroy the Jewish people. And this benevolent king, when he became aware of the plot and what exactly was taking place, so in the evil designs, the truly evil designs of Haman, he had him hung, put him to death. You know, to show how the king looked out for the welfare of the citizens of the empire. So we didn't. Now, where does this come from, this story? This is not a Jewish story. This comes straight from the king's archives. This is a synopsis, as it were, of the official papers surrounding this episode, this period in Persian history, and how it played out. If you want the whole story is in the king's archives. You know. For brevity's sake, we're giving you the synopsis. You know, the Watergate papers were 40,000 pages long, so they produced one paperback book that had the synopsis, all the eco lines they had, so you cut through the chaff. So that's it. So we're presenting, this is a celebration, the Persian, celebrating the benevolent king of the Persian Empire. And this is from the official records of the king that this is recorded. And that was our answer. This is a Persian celebration, celebrating the nobility of our great king. And that's why we had to paint them up well. We didn't speak about the Rabbeinu Shel Olam except in subtle fashion. Because that's the only way we could celebrate Alad Vasnecha. We are a Kati Abdi Achashverosh Haman. We don't have our own country. We don't have our own sovereignty. We don't have our own army. We don't have our own protection. So we don't have our own king. We're subjects of a foreign king. We can't sing the halal of halal mitzri on this day. This is a truncated Yeshua. It's a partial Yeshua. So we sing a different halal on this day. And a halal which is matim, a halal which fits with the vicissitudes of Golos. The final parak of the Megillah, what's it about? It seems really superfluous. You know, we have in the Gemara debates where we should start the Megillah from Ish Yehudi, from Ahivi Me'achashash, all types of views. So good. So we pass in like Ramea, we start from the beginning in the Megillah, that we need to study the whole roots. The Chatoim, which brought about the rise of Haman, the Parasha of Haman, how we defeated Haman, the aftermath of Haman, how we secured Klal Yisrael for. V'ayosam ha-melech ha-chashash mash, ala oretz v'yayayom. Whatever we wanted. You know? So now the king came and levied taxes. What's new in history? What's the point? What's it relevant to the story of the Megillah? But it's relevant to the aftermath of the Megillah. And it's a relevant lesson in Golos. How does Mordechai keep power? He got into power. How does he keep power? Very simply, he makes the king rich. He exacts tribute from all the Medinas. And he lines the king's treasury like never before. You know, Achashverosh says, listen, I don't care if he's Chinese, if he's Belgian, or he's Jewish, if the money's flowing in. You know, it's fine. What did the mafia do? Listen, they can have a Jew, Mayor Lansky, run the Geld for them. If the Geld is moving, they're making money, that's it. It doesn't, the rest doesn't make a difference. So Mordechai understood this. So what did he do? He established a system of taxation. And he made the king rich. As long as the king was getting rich, Mordechai was hot stuff. So it tells us again how Mordechai, in fact, how he got into office. How did he stay in office? The king, whatever, listen, what, any shortage of detractors? What's this Jew doing running the country? Do you have any thoughts, whatever, that this can take place 100 times over? The king got one answer. Listen, get out of here. The guy's making me rich, and that's it. So long, you know? Business is good. The money's pouring in. I have to keep building more vaults for the treasure that he brings. That's it. This was also part of the cunning of Mordechai. He went into office, he had a purpose, and how he succeeded in the office that the king wanted him to stay. A king, an anti-Semitic king, a Jew hater. And who's his right-hand man? Is a Jew. And not for a short period of time, for years on end. How did it work? The money's good. When the money's good, there's nothing to argue about. So we look at the process of the Megillah and its depth as a phenomenal Yeshua. We overcame our own chaton. We succeeded with the Rebbeinu Shlomo's help in overcoming Haman. Achashverosh swings temporarily to our side to allow us to eliminate our Asanim. And finally, our Mordechai keeps power all of these years in an atmosphere which was certainly not friendly to having a Jew running the government. Yesterday we wanted to kill all of them, and today a Jew is running the government? This was part of what takes place in the Megillah. And that really explains Esther needed to stress the king's backing for this enterprise. There's a very strange pasuk. It says that they killed the 10 sons of Haman and Haman, and then she comes to the king and she says, what does she want? She wants one more day to root out the Haman's following entrenched in the capital in Shushan. Okay, so you understand, he was a power broker in Shushan, he had a lot of his henchmen there, so they needed another day to take care of them. But then she makes a really strange request, you know, as the world has long observed, capital punishment can only be given out once. So what's it going to help? You strung them up and they're dead, so what do you want now? What are you stringing them up again for? The answer is because, and the society is Byzantine, is Achashverosh, you never know where anything's coming from. The fact that Haman and his 10 sons were killed, who did it? Who's responsible for it? Was it some rival power group that had a grudge against Haman? And that's it. It was basically a terrorist strike. And they came and they appeared, they grabbed Haman and his 10 sons, they strung them up and they ran away. But that wouldn't help the Jews if that took place. The only thing that would help the Jews if it was clear that this was done with the authority of the king. The king wanted this done. Then if the king wanted this done, we could achieve the end, Kinafor Pachad Mordechai Aleihem. If the king is behind all of this, then we better get in line. How do you establish if the king's behind it or not? And this again was the whole play, where the Jews are standing, where the Jew haters are. They're ready to pounce. Will they pounce or won't they pounce? So at this juncture, Mordechai yet did not have the full power yet. So what did she do? The way to tell is a very simple way. Terrorists can strike any place, law or later. We live in a world, we know it. I was in Paris a week ago Sunday. And on the way to the airport, I passed Hyper Kosher, the site of where the terrorist attack on the Jewish market took place last year. Outside the market, there are two French soldiers in uniform standing with machine guns. Imagine you go to Wasserman and there's two guys outside with machine guns. I passed the shul in Paris, and there were three soldiers. A tiny little street, I think narrower than Meir Shorim. just about, or not much wider than that, and they're right opposite the front door of Shul. There's three soldiers with guns permanently on patrol. So how do you know who's responsible? It's very simple. You can do whatever you want, but if you're a terrorist group, you strike and you run away. What will the king do then, if it's not according to his will? The security forces will come, they'll cut them down, and that's it. And by tomorrow morning, there'll be no sign that anything took place. Everything will be back to normal. If they can hang on a pole downtown in the capital city, there the king certainly is in charge. For them to stay up for 24 hours cannot happen unless Ahasuerus wants it to happen. If he doesn't want it to happen, his security forces will come and cut him down and take him away. The only way this could happen, it can't be a terrorist strike, is if the king is behind it. The fact that Ahasuerus ben Haman yislu alaitz, this was another step in securing the survival of Klal Yisrael from this episode. This invoked the king's authority for what they were doing. So this is a major aspect that runs through the Megillah of how, in fact, we are to survive the victory. To survive the victory of Purim. We could have very easily won the battle and lost the war. So this is a major theme throughout the entire Megillah of how not only we won the battle with Haman, but we won the war against his people too. There was a tremendous, tremendous amount of siyata dishmaya and many, many steps to bring us to this end. So this is one of the celebrations of Purim, the Yeshua of Purim, that how enormous